spoiled them, Red. Never denied them a thing. They'll be lost. Arthur, my Archie. You know what he's like, Red. Where else have you seen kids like that?
I told you. If I can, I'll get you out.
No, Burbage said stubbornly. You'll get me out. Either way. The Golden Sphere. Want me to tell you where it is?
Fine. Tell me.
Burbage moaned and shifted. My legs, he groaned. Can you feel them?
Redrick stretched out his arm and, examining, ran his hand along the leg below the knee.
Bones, wheezed Burbage. Are there still bones?
Yes, yes, lied Redrick. Don't worry. Actually, he could only feel the kneecap. Below there, all the way down to the heel, the leg felt like a rubber stick. You could tie it in knots.
You're lying, said Burbage. Why are you lying? What do you think? I don't know. You think I never seen this before?
The knees are okay, said Redrick.
You're probably lying again, Burbage said miserably. Forget it. Just get me out of here. I'll give you everything. The Golden Sphere. Draw your map. Show you all the traps. Tell you everything.
He kept talking and promising things, but Redrick was no longer listening. He was looking toward the road. The searchlights had stopped darting through the bushes. They had frozen, converging on that same marble obelisk, and in the bright blue fog, Redrick distinctly saw a hunched figure wandering between the crosses. The figure seemed to be moving blindly, heading right toward the searchlights. Redrick saw it crash into a huge cross, stagger back, bump into the cross again, and only then go around it and keep going, stretching long arms with fingers spread wide in front of it. Then it suddenly disappeared, as if falling through the ground, and in a few seconds appeared again, farther and to the right, walking with an absurd, inhuman persistence like a wind-up toy. And the searchlights abruptly went off. The clutch started grinding, the motor roared to life. Red and blue signal lights flashed through the bushes, and the patrol car took off. It sped up furiously, flew toward town, and disappeared behind the wall. Redrick swallowed hard and unzipped his jumpsuit.
They left, Burbage muttered feverishly. Let's go, Red, hurry up. He fidgeted, groped around him, grabbed the bag of swag, and tried to sit up. Come on, what are you waiting for?
Redrick kept looking toward the road. It was now dark, and he couldn't see a thing, but that one was out there somewhere, marching like a wind-up toy, stumbling, falling, crashing into crosses, getting tangled in bushes. All right, Redrick said aloud. Let's go. He picked Burbage up. The old man clutched his neck with a pincer-like grip, and Redrick, unable to get up, dragged him on all fours through the gap in the wall, gripping the wet grass with his hands.
Keep going, Burbage pleaded. Don't worry, I got the swag. I won't let go. Keep going.
He knew the way, but the wet grass was slippery. The branches whipped his face, and the corpulent old man was impossibly heavy, like a corpse. And then there was the bag of swag, which, knocking and clanging, kept getting caught, and he was terrified of stumbling on that one, who might be roaming here in the dark. When they came out onto the road, it was still completely dark, but dawn was palpably near. In the grove across the highway, the birds were beginning to chirp sleepily. The night sky over the distant black houses and sparse yellow streetlights of the outskirts had already turned blue, and there was a damp, chilly breeze. Redrick lay Burbage down on the side of the road, glanced around, and looking like a gigantic black spider, ran across it. He quickly found their jeep, swept the masking branches off the hood and trunk, got behind the wheel, and carefully, without turning on the headlights, drove onto the pavement. Burbage was sitting up, holding the bag with one hand and with the other feeling his legs.
Hurry up, he rasped. Hurry up and go. My knees. I still have my knees. If I could save my knees.
Redrick picked him up and, gritting his teeth from the effort, threw him into the car. Burbage collapsed onto the back seat with a thud and moaned. He still hadn't let go of the bag. Redrick picked the lead-lined jacket up off the ground and threw it over him. Burbage had even managed to drag the jacket along. Redrick took out a flashlight and went back and forth along the side of the road looking for tracks. There were almost none. As it rolled onto the road, the jeep had flattened the tall, thick grass, but in a couple of hours, this grass would stand up. The area around the spot where the patrol car had been was littered with cigarette butts. Redrick remembered that he'd long wanted to smoke, took out a cigarette and lit up, even though what he most wanted right now was to jump in the car and speed away. But he couldn't do that yet. Everything had to be carefully thought through. "What's going on?" whined Burbage from the car. "You haven't poured out the water. The fishing gear is dry. Why are you standing there? Hide the swag." "Shut up," said Redrick. "Get off my back." He took a drag on his cigarette. "We'll drive through the southern outskirts," he said. "The outskirts? Are you nuts? You'll ruin my knees, asshole, my knees." Redrick took a last drag and stuffed the butt into a matchbox. "Calm down, Vulture," he said. "We can't go through town. There are three checkpoints on the way. We'll get stopped at one of them at least." "So what?" "So they'll take one look at your legs and we're finished."
"What about my legs? We were fishing with dynamite. My legs got blasted, that's all."
"And if someone touches them?"
"Touches them? I'll scream so loud they'll never touch a leg again."
But Redrick had already decided. He turned on the flashlight, lifted the driver's seat, opened the secret hatch, and said, "Give me the swag." The spare fuel tank under the seat was fake. Redrick took the bag and shoved it inside, listening to the clanging, rolling sounds coming from within. "I can't risk it," he mumbled. "I've got no right." He closed the hatch, sprinkled some garbage on top, threw some rags over it, and lowered the seat. Burbage was grunting, moaning, plaintively demanding he hurry up. Then he was again promising the golden sphere, the entire time fidgeting in his seat, staring anxiously into the lightning sky. Redrick paid no attention. He ripped open the plastic bag of water with the fish, poured out the water onto the fishing gear piled on the bottom of the trunk, and threw the wriggling fish into a canvas bag. After that, he folded the plastic bag and stuffed it into his pocket. Now everything was in order. Two fishermen were returning from a moderately successful expedition. He got behind the wheel and started the car. He drove all the way to the turn without switching on his headlights. To their left stretched the immense 9-foot wall that guarded the zone, while to their right were bushes, thin groves, and the occasional abandoned cottage with boarded-up windows and peeling paint. Redrick had good night vision, and in any case, the darkness was no longer that thick. Besides, he knew it was coming, so when the steadily walking, bent figure appeared ahead, he didn't even slow down. He only hunched over the wheel. That one was marching right in the middle of the road. Like the rest of them, he was walking to town. Redrick passed him, driving on the shoulder, and then pressed hard on the gas. "My God," mumbled Burbage from the back. "Red, did you see that?"
"Yeah," said Redrick.
"Jesus, that's all we need," Burbage muttered, and then immediately began reciting a loud prayer.
"Shut up," snapped Redrick. The turn had to be here somewhere. Redrick slowed down, examining the row of lopsided houses and fences stretching to their right. An old transformer booth, an electric pole, a rotting bridge over a ditch. Redrick turned the wheel. The car bounced over a pothole.
"Where you going?" Burbage shrieked loudly. "You'll ruin my legs, bastard."
Redrick quickly turned around and slapped him, feeling the old man's stubbly cheek with the back of his hand. Burbage sputtered and shut up. The car bounced up and down, and the wheels constantly skidded in the fresh dirt left by the night's rain. Redrick turned on the headlights. Dancing white light illuminated the old, overgrown tire tracks, the giant puddles, the rotting, slanted fences by the side. Burbage was crying, sniffling, and blowing his nose. He no longer promised things. He threatened and complained, but very quietly and indistinctly, so Redrick could only make out single words, something about legs, about knees, about beautiful Archie. And he quieted down. The village stretched beside the western border of town. Once upon a time, there were cottages here, gardens, fruit orchards, and the summer residences of city officials and factory administrators. There were lovely green spaces, small lakes with clean sandy banks, transparent birch groves, and ponds stocked with carp. The factory stench and acrid factory smoke never reached here, although neither did the city sewer system. Now everything was deserted and abandoned, and throughout the drive they only saw one occupied house. The curtained window was yellow with light, rain-soaked laundry hung on the line, and a giant dog had rushed out of the yard, barking furiously, and chased the car in the clouds of dirt thrown up by the wheels. Redrick carefully drove over another old crooked bridge, and, when the turn to the western highway appeared ahead, stopped the car and turned off the engine. He climbed out onto the road without looking at Burbridge and walked forward, shivering and stuffing his hands into his damp jumpsuit pockets. It was now light out. The world was wet, quiet, and sleepy. He reached the highway and cautiously looked out from behind the bushes. From here, it was easy to see the police outpost, a little trailer on wheels, three windows shining with light and smoke rising from the tall, narrow chimney. A patrol car was parked nearby with no one inside. For some time, Redrick stood there and watched. The outpost was completely still. The patrols were probably cold and weary from the night's vigil and were now warming up in their trailer, nodding off with cigarettes stuck to their lower lips. "Toads," Redrick said quietly. He felt the brass knuckles in his pocket, put his fingers through the rings, gripped the cold metal in his fist, and walked back, still shivering and keeping his hands in his pockets. The jeep was standing between the bushes, tilting slightly. They were in a remote, deserted place. It had probably been a decade since anyone had been there. When Redrick approached the car, Burbridge sat up and looked at him, mouth agape. Right now he seemed even older than usual, wrinkled, bald, covered in dirty stubble, rotten-toothed. For some time they silently looked at each other, and suddenly Burbridge mumbled, "Give you a map. All the traps, all of them. Find it yourself. You won't be sorry." Redrick listened to him, motionless. Then he unclenched his fingers, let go of the brass knuckles in his pocket, and said, "Fine. You gotta be unconscious, okay? Moan and don't let them touch you." He got into the car, started the engine, and drove forward. And everything turned out okay. No one left the trailer when the jeep, in strict accordance with the road signs and instructions, slowly rolled by and then, quickly picking up speed, flew toward town through the southern outskirts. It was 6 a.m. The streets were empty. The pavement was wet and black, and the traffic lights at the intersections kept a lonely and pointless vigil. They passed a bakery with tall, brightly lit windows, and Redrick let the warm, incredibly delicious aroma wash over him. "I'm starving," said Redrick, and kneading his muscles, which were stiff from the tension, stretched, pushing his hands into the wheel. "What?" said Burbridge in alarm. "I said I'm starving. Where are we going? Your house is straight to the butcher." "To the butcher! To the butcher, quick!" Burbridge babbled impatiently, his whole body leaning forward, his hot, feverish breath on Redrick's neck. "Go straight there, right now. He still owes me 700. Go, go quickly. Why are you crawling like an injured snail?" And then he suddenly began to curse, impotently and spitefully, using vile, dirty words, showering Redrick with spittle, gasping and coughing in fits. Redrick didn't answer. He didn't have the time or the energy to soothe the raging vulture. He had to quickly finish with all this and catch at least an hour, a half hour of sleep, before the meeting at the Metropole. He turned onto 16th Street, drove two blocks, and parked the car in front of the gray two-story house. The butcher opened the door himself. He probably had just gotten up and was going to the bathroom. He was wearing a splendid robe with gold tassels and holding a glass with dentures in his hand. His hair was tousled, and there were dark circles under his dull eyes. Oh, he said. Red, a shoe? What is it? Put in your teeth and let's go, said Redrick. Uh-huh, replied the butcher, nodding invitingly toward the foyer and shuffling his feet in Persian slippers and moving with surprising speed, he headed to the bathroom. Who? He asked from within. Burbridge, answered Redrick. What? Legs. In the bathroom, water started running. He heard snorting and splashing, and then something fell and rolled along the tile floor. Redrick wearily sat down in an armchair, took out a cigarette, and, looking around, lit up. Yeah, this was quite the foyer. The butcher must have spent a bundle. He was a very skilled and very fashionable surgeon, renowned in the medical community, not only of the city, but of the state, and of course the reason he got mixed up with stalkers wasn't the money. Like many others, he profited from the zone by receiving swag and then applying it in his practice, by treating crippled stalkers in the process investigating mysterious new injuries, diseases, and deformities of the human body, and by becoming famous as the first doctor on the planet to specialize in non-human illnesses of man. Although, to be honest, he also eagerly took the money. What exactly is wrong with his legs, he asked, emerging from the bathroom with a huge towel draped over his shoulder. He was carefully wiping his long, nervous fingers with a corner of the towel. Got into the slime, said Redrick. The butcher whistled. So, that's the end of Burbridge, he muttered. Too bad, he was a famous stalker. Nah, said Redrick, leaning back in his chair. He'll make prosthesis for him. He'll hop through the zone on prosthesis yet. Well, okay, said the butcher. His face became completely professional. Give me a second, I'll get dressed. While he got dressed and talked on the phone, probably instructing his clinic to prepare for the surgery, Redrick lounged motionless in the armchair and smoked. He only moved once to take out his flask. He drank in small sips, since the flask was almost empty, and tried not to think about anything. He simply waited. Then they both walked to the car. Redrick got behind the wheel, and the butcher sat down next to him, immediately leaning over the seat and feeling Burbridge's legs. Burbridge hushed and deflated, mumbled something plaintive, promised untold riches, constantly mentioning his children and dead wife, and begging him to at least save his knees. When they drove up to the clinic, the butcher cursed at not finding the orderlies outside, jumped out of the still-moving car, and disappeared behind the door. Redrick lit another cigarette, and Burbridge suddenly spoke clearly and distinctly, as if he was completely calm. You wanted to kill me. I'll remember that. But I didn't, said Redrick indifferently. No, you didn't, Burbridge was quiet. I'll remember that, too. You do that, said Redrick. You, of course, wouldn't have killed me. He turned around and looked at Burbridge. The old man was grimacing uncertainly, twisting his parched lips. You'd have just abandoned me, said Redrick. Left me in the zone, and that would be that. Like Four Eyes. Four Eyes died on his own, Burbridge sullenly disagreed. I had nothing to do with it. He got stuck. You scum, said Redrick dispassionately, turning away. A vulture. Two disheveled, sleepy orderlies jumped out of the door, and unfolding the stretchers they ran, rushed up to the car. Redrick, taking occasional drags of his cigarette, watched as they dexterously pulled Burbridge from the back seat, laid him down on the stretcher, and carried him to the door. Burbridge was lying motionless, crossing his arms on his chest and staring remotely into the sky. His huge feet, cruelly damaged by the slime, were strangely and unnaturally bent. He was the last of the old stalkers, the ones that began the search for alien treasures immediately after the visit, when the zone wasn't yet called the zone, and there was no institute, no wall, and no UN police force. When the town was paralyzed by terror and the world giggled over the latest newspaper hoax. At the time, Redrick was 10 years old, and Burbridge was still a strong and agile man. He loved drinking on someone else's dime, brawling and chasing girls. Back then, he had absolutely no interest in his children, but he was already a piece of scum. When drunk, he got some vile pleasure out of beating his wife, loudly, so everyone could hear. Eventually, he beat her to death. Frederick turned the Jeep around and, paying no attention to the traffic lights, cutting corners and honking at the rare pedestrians, sped straight home. He stopped in front of the garage and, getting out of the car, saw the superintendent walking toward him from the park. As usual, the superintendent was in a foul mood, and his flabby, puffy-eyed face expressed extreme distaste, as if he weren't walking on solid earth but wading through a field of manure. "Good morning," said Redrick politely. The superintendent stopped 2 steps away and jabbed his thumb over his shoulder. "Did you do that?" he asked indistinctly. It was clear these were his first words of the day. "Do what?" "That swing. Did you put it up?"
"I did."
"What for?"
Redrick didn't answer. Went up to the gates of the garage and unlocked them. The superintendent followed and stopped right behind him.
"I'm asking you, why did you put up the swing? Who asked you to do that?"
"My daughter asked," said Redrick very calmly. He rolled the gates open.
"I'm not talking about your daughter," the superintendent raised his voice. "Your daughter is a separate topic. I'm asking who gave you permission. Who exactly said you could rearrange the park?"
Redrick turned toward him and for a while stood motionless, gazing fixedly at the man's pale, veined nose. The superintendent took a step back and said in a lower tone, "And you don't repaint the balcony. How many times do I have to—"
"Don't waste your breath," said Redrick. "I'm not going to leave."
He went back to the car and turned on the engine. As he put his hands on the steering wheel, he noticed that his knuckles had turned white. Then he leaned out of the car and, no longer controlling himself, said, "But if you do make me leave, asshole, you better say a prayer." He drove the car into the garage, turned on the light, and closed the gates. He pulled a bag of swag out of the false gas tank, cleaned up the car, stuffed the bag into an old wicker basket, and put the fishing gear, still damp and covered in leaves, on top. Finally, he dumped in the fish, which Burbridge had bought in the outskirts last night. Then he again examined the car from every side, just out of habit. He found a flattened cigarette stuck to the rear right tire. Redrick peeled it off. The cigarette was Swedish. Redrick thought about it, then stuffed it into a matchbox. The box already contained 3 butts. He didn't meet anyone on the stairs. He stopped in front of his door, and it opened before he could take out its key. He walked in sideways with a heavy basket under his arm and soaked in the familiar warmth, the familiar smells of his home. Gouda hugged him around the neck and stayed still, her face pressed into his chest. Even through the thick layers of his clothing, he felt the frantic beating of her heart. He didn't get in her way. He stood there patiently and waited until she came around, although that was precisely the moment he realized how exhausted and drained he was. "All right," she said eventually in a low, husky voice. She let go of him, turned on the light in the corridor, and without turning around, went to the kitchen. "I'll make you coffee," she called out. "I brought you some fish," he said in a deliberately cheerful voice. "Fry them up, every one. I'm dying of hunger." She returned, hiding her face in her hair. He put the basket on the floor and helped her take out the bag of fish. Then they carried the bag together into the kitchen and dumped the fish into the sink. "Go wash up," she said. "By the time you're done, the food'll be ready." "How's the monkey?" said Redrick, sitting down and pulling off his boots. "Oh, she chattered all evening," replied Gouda. "Barely managed to put her to bed. Wouldn't leave me alone. Where's Daddy? Where's Daddy? Give her Daddy right then and there." She moved silently and gracefully through the kitchen, so capable and lovely. And water was already boiling on the stove, and fish scales were flying from under the knife, and oil sputtered in the biggest frying pan, and the incredible smell of fresh coffee spread through the air. Redrick got up, and walking barefoot, came back to the front door, picked up the basket, and carried it to the den.
On the way, he glanced into the bedroom. The monkey was dozing peacefully. Her blanket hung to the floor, her nightie was riding up, and he could see her whole body. She was a small, sleeping animal. Redvick couldn't resist it and stroked her back, covered in warm, golden fur, and for the 100th time marveled at how silky and long it was. He really wanted to pick her up, but he was worried he'd wake her. And besides, he was dirty as hell, drenched in the zone and death. He came back to the kitchen, sat down at the table, and said, "Pour me a cup of coffee. I'll shower in a bit." There was a stack of evening mail on the table. The Harmont Times. An athlete, a playboy. A whole bunch of magazines had arrived. And there were also the thick, gray-covered reports of the International Institute of Extraterrestrial Cultures. Redvick took a steaming mug of coffee from Guta and pulled the reports toward him. Squiggles, weird symbols, diagrams. The photos depicted familiar objects from strange angles. Another one of Kirill's posthumous papers had been published. A surprising property of magnetic traps of type 77B. The name Panoff was framed in black, and there was a note in small print. "Dr. Kirill A. Panoff, USSR, tragically perished while conducting an experiment in April of 19-something. Redrick tossed the magazine away, gulped down some burning hot coffee, and asked, "Did anyone come by?" "Gudelin dropped by," said Guta, after a slight pause. She was standing next to the stove and looking at him. "He was totally drunk. I threw him out." "How did the monkey take it?" "Didn't want him to go, of course. Almost started bawling, but I told her that Uncle Gudelin wasn't feeling well, and she replied understandingly, 'Uncle Gudelin is sloshed again.'" Redvick chuckled and took another sip. Then he asked, "How about the neighbors?" And again Guta hesitated a bit before answering. "Same as usual," she said, eventually. "Fine. Don't tell me." "Oh," she said, waving her hand in disgust. "That hag from downstairs knocked during the night, eyes bulging, foaming at the mouth. Why the hell are we sawing in the bathroom at night?"
"Bitch," said Redrick through his teeth. "Listen, maybe we really should move. Buy a house in the outskirts where no one lives, get some abandoned cottage."
"What about the monkey?"
"My God," said Redrick, "don't you think the two of us could figure out how to make her happy?"
Guta shook her head. "She loves children, and they love her. It's not their fault that—"
"Yes," said Redrick. "It's definitely not their fault."
"No use talking about it," said Guta. "Oh, someone called for you, didn't leave a name. I said you were out fishing."
Redrick put the cup down and stood up. "All right," he said. "I really should go shower. I still have a lot to do." He locked the bathroom, threw his clothes into a tub, and put the brass knuckles, remaining screws and other odds and ends, on a shelf. He spent a long time under the hot, almost boiling water, groaning and scrubbing his body with a coarse sponge until his skin turned red. Then he turned off the shower, sat on the side of the tub, and lit a cigarette. Water was gurgling through the pipes. Guta was clinking dishes in the kitchen, and he smelled fried fish. Then Guta knocked on the door and handed him clean underwear. "Hurry up," she commanded. "The fish is getting cold." She had completely recovered and was issuing orders again. Chuckling, Redrick got dressed. That is, he pulled on boxers and a T-shirt, and wearing this outfit, came back to the kitchen. "Now I can have some food," he said, sitting down. "Did you put your clothes in the tub?" asked Guta. "Uh-huh," he said, with his mouth full. "Great fish. Did you pour water over them?" "No. My fault, sir. Won't happen again, sir. Come on. Do that later. Have a seat." He caught her hand and tried to put her on his knees, but she slipped away and sat across from him. "Neglecting your husband, huh?" said Redrick, filling his mouth again. "Giving him the cold shoulder." "Some husband you are right now," said Guta. "An empty sack instead of a husband.
First you have to be stuffed. Hey, anything's possible, said Redrick. Don't you believe in miracles? That would be quite the miracle. Want a drink?
Redrick played indecisively with his fork.
No, probably not, he said. He looked at his watch and got up. I should go now. Could you prepare a suit for me, make it first rate, with a dress shirt and tie? Enjoying the sensation of the cool floor on his bare feet, he walked to the den and barred the door. He put on a rubber apron, pulled on elbow-high rubber gloves, and started unloading the items in the bag onto the table. Two empties, box of pins, 9 batteries, 3 bracelets, and another hoop, resembling a bracelet but made from a white metal, lighter and about an inch larger in diameter. 16 black sparks in a plastic bag, 2 perfectly preserved sponges close to a fist in size, 3 shriekers, a jar of carbonated clay. There was still a heavy porcelain container packed carefully in fiberglass remaining in the bag, but Redrick left it alone. He took out his cigarettes and lit up, looking over the swag laid out on the table. Then he pulled out a drawer and took out a piece of paper, a pencil stub, and his balance sheet. Holding the cigarette in the corner of his mouth and squinting from the smoke, he wrote down number after number, lining them up in 3 columns and adding the first 2. The sums turned out to be impressive. He crushed the cigarette in the ashtray, carefully opened the box, and poured the pins out onto the paper. In the electric light, the pins looked shot with blue and would on rare occasion burst into pure spectral colors, red, yellow, green. He picked up one pin and, being careful not to prick himself, squeezed it between his finger and thumb. He turned off the light and waited a little, getting used to the dark. But the pin was silent. He put it aside, groped for another one, and also squeezed it between his fingers. Nothing. He squeezed harder, risking a prick. And the pin started talking. Weak, reddish sparks ran along it and changed all at once to rarer, green ones. For a couple of seconds, Redrick admired this strange light show, which, as he learned from the reports, had to mean something, possibly something very significant. Then he put the pin down separately from the first one and picked up a new one. Overall, there were 73 pins, out of which 12 talked and the rest were silent. Actually, these would also talk, but fingers weren't enough. You needed a special machine the size of a table. Redrick turned on the light and added 2 numbers to those already on the page, and only after this did he make up his mind. He shoved both hands into the bag and, holding his breath, took out the package and put it on the table. He stared at it for some time, pensively scratching his chin with the back of his hand. Then he finally picked up a pencil, spun it in his clumsy rubber fingers, and threw it down again. He took out another cigarette and, without lifting his eyes from the package, smoked it whole. "To hell with this," he said loudly, resolutely picked up the package and stuffed it back into the bag. "That's it. That's enough." He quickly poured the pins back into the box and rose from the table. It was time to go. He could probably nap for half an hour to clear his head, but on the other hand, he might be smarter to arrive early and get a sense of things. He took off his gloves, hung up the apron, and without turning off the light, left the den. The suit was already laid out on the bed, and Redrick began to dress. He was tying his tie in front of a mirror when the floorboards squeaked softly behind him. He heard agitated breathing, and he had to make a serious face to avoid laughing. "Boo!" a high voice suddenly yelled beside him, and he felt someone grab his leg. "Ah!" exclaimed Redrick, collapsing on the bed. The monkey, squealing and shouting with laughter, immediately climbed on top of him. She stepped on him, pulled his hair, and showered him with important information. The neighbor kid, Willie, tore Dolly's leg off. There was a new kitten on the third floor, all white with red eyes. He probably didn't listen to his mommy and went into the zone. There was oatmeal and jam for supper. Uncle Goodlin was sloshed again and felt sick. He even cried. Why don't fish drown if they're in water? Why wasn't mommy sleeping at night? Why do we have five fingers but only two arms and one nose? Redrick carefully hugged the warm creature crawling all over him, looked into the huge, entirely black eyes with no whites, pressed his face to the chubby little cheek covered in silky golden fur, and repeated, "My monkey, oh, you monkey, what a little monkey!" The phone rang sharply in his ear. He stretched out a hand and picked up the receiver. "Yes?" There was no response. "Hello?" said Redrick. "Hello?" No one answered. Then there was a click, and he heard a series of short beeps. After this, Redrick stood up, put the monkey down on the floor, and no longer listening to her, put on his jacket and pants. The monkey chattered without pause, but he only smiled absent-mindedly, and so it was eventually announced that Daddy must have bitten, then swallowed his tongue, and he was left alone. He came back to the den, put the items on the table into his briefcase, stopped by the bathroom to get the brass knuckles, and again returned to the den, took the briefcase in one hand and the wicker basket in the other, and went out, carefully locking the den door and shouting to Gouda, "I'm leaving." "When are you coming back?" asked Gouda, coming in from the kitchen. She had already brushed her hair and put makeup on, and she was no longer wearing a bathrobe, but had changed into a dress, his favorite one, bright blue and low cut. "I'll call you," he said, looking at her, then came up to her, bent down, and kissed her cleavage. "Well, go on," said Gouda quietly. "And me? What about me?" hollered the monkey, climbing between them. He had to bend down even farther. Gouda was looking at him with frozen eyes. "It's nothing," he said. "Don't worry, I'll call you." In the stairwell on the floor below, Redrick met a heavy man in striped pajamas who stood in front of his door, fiddling with his lock. From the dark recesses of his apartment wafted a warm smell of sour cooking. Redrick stopped and said, "Good morning." The heavy man looked warily at him over his huge shoulder and mumbled something. "Your wife came by last night," said Redrick. "Thought we were sawing something. There must have been a mistake." "What's it to me?" grumbled the man in pajamas. "My wife was doing the laundry last night," continued Redrick. "If we bothered you, I apologize." "I didn't say anything," said the man in pajamas. "Feel free." "Well, I'm very glad," said Redrick. He went downstairs, stopped by the garage, put the basket down in the corner, covered it with an old seat cushion, took one last look, and came out onto the street. It wasn't a long walk, 2 blocks to the square, a bit through the park, and another block until Central Avenue. As usual, the street in front of the Metropole gleamed with the chrome and lacquer of a colorful collection of cars. Doormen in raspberry uniforms lugged suitcases toward the entrance, and some respectable foreign-looking men congregated in groups of 2 or 3 on the marble staircase, chatting and smoking cigars. Redrick decided not to go there yet. He settled under the awning of a small café across the street, ordered coffee and lit up. At a table 2 steps away, he saw 3 undercover members of the International Police Force sitting silently, hastily stuffing themselves with fried sausages a la Harmont, and drinking dark beer from tall glass steins. On his other side, about 10 steps away, some sergeant was gloomily scarfing down fried potatoes, holding his fork in his fist. His blue helmet was upside down on the floor beside him, and his holster was hanging on the back of his chair. No one else was in the café. The waitress, an unfamiliar middle-aged woman, stood off to the side and yawned occasionally, tactfully covering her painted mouth with her hand. It was 9:20. Redrick watched as Richard Noonan came out of the hotel, munching on something and pulling a soft hat over his ears. He briskly marched down the stairs, Small, fat, and pink, the picture of prosperity and good health, freshly washed and cheerful, completely convinced that the day would be a good one. He waved to someone, threw his rolled-up jacket over his right shoulder, and walked to his Peugeot. Vic's Peugeot was itself round, short, and freshly washed, and somehow also gave the impression of total optimism. Hiding his face behind his hand, Redrick watched Noonan fussily and industriously settle in behind the wheel, moving an item from the front seat to the back, bending down to pick up something, and adjusting the rearview mirror. The Peugeot coughed out a puff of bluish smoke, beeped at some African in a burnoose, and briskly rolled onto the street. From the looks of things, Noonan was heading to the Institute and therefore would go around the fountain and drive past the café. It was now too late to get up and go, so Redrick just covered his whole face with his hand and hunched over his cup. Unfortunately, this didn't help. The Peugeot beeped right in his ear. The brakes squealed, and Noonan's cheerful voice called out, "Hey, Shuhart! Red!" Cursing under his breath, Redrick lifted his head. Noonan was already walking toward him, stretching out his hand. He was beaming. "What are you doing here this early?" he asked when he came closer. "Thanks, dear," he called to the waitress. "I don't need anything." And then, again addressing Redrick, "Haven't seen you in ages. Where you been hiding? What have you been doing with yourself?" "Not much," said Redrick without enthusiasm. "This and that." He watched as Noonan, fussy and meticulous as always, settled on the chair across from him, his plump little hands pushing the napkin holder to one side and the sandwich plate to the other, and he listened as he chattered amicably. "You look kind of beat, not getting enough sleep. You know, I've been run off my feet myself with the new machinery, but sleep. No, my friend, sleep's the first thing. Screw the machinery." He suddenly looked around. "Pardon me, maybe you're waiting for someone. Am I bothering you?" No, said Redrick listlessly. "I just had a bit of time, thought I'd at least have a cup of coffee." "All right, I won't keep you long," Dick said and looked at his watch. "Listen, Red, why don't you drop your this and your that and come back to the Institute? You know they take you back in a second. They just got a new Russian. I want to work with him." Redrick shook his head. "No," he said. "The next Kirill hasn't been born yet. Besides, there's nothing for me to do at your Institute. It's all automated now. The robots go into the zone. The robots, I suppose, also get the bonuses. And lab assistant salary? That won't even cover my tobacco." Noonan disagreed. "Come on, that could all be sorted out." "And I don't like it when other people sort things out for me," said Redrick. "I've been sorting things out myself my whole life and plan to continue that way." "You've gotten proud," Noonan said reproachfully. "I'm not proud. I just don't like counting pennies, that's all." "Well, you got a point," said Noonan absentmindedly. He glanced casually at Redrick's briefcase sitting on the nearby chair and rubbed his finger over the silver plating with the Cyrillic engraving. "That's exactly right. A man needs money in order to never think about it." "A present from Kirill?" he asked, nodding at the briefcase. "My inheritance," said Redrick. "Why haven't I seen you at the Borscht lately?"
"More like I haven't seen you," said Noonan. "I almost always eat dinner there. Here at the Metropole, everything costs an arm and a leg." "Listen," he said suddenly. "How are you doing for money?"
"Want to borrow some?" asked Redrick.
"On the contrary."
"Then you want to lend some?"
"There's work," said Noonan.
"Oh, God," said Redrick, "not you too."
"Who else?" Noonan asked immediately.
"Oh, there are a lot of you, employers."
Noonan, as if he just understood, started laughing.
No, this isn't related to your primary career."
"Then what?"
Noonan checked his watch again.
"Listen," he said, getting up. "Drop by the Borscht today at lunchtime, around 1. We'll talk."
"I might not make it by 1, said Redrick.
"Then in the evening, around 6, all right?"
"We'll see," said Redrick, and also checked his watch. It was 5 to 9.
Noonan waved and toddled off to his Peugeot.
Redrick watched him leave, called the waitress, asked for a pack of Lucky Strikes, paid the bill, and, picking up his briefcase, walked leisurely across the street to the hotel. The sun was already hot, the street was rapidly becoming muggy, and Redrick's eyes were starting to sting. He squeezed them shut, regretting that he didn't have a chance to nap before this important deal. And then it happened. He had never felt this outside of the zone, and even in the zone it had only happened two or three times. Suddenly he seemed to be in another world. A million smells assaulted him at once, smells that were sharp, sweet, metallic, dangerous, caressing, disturbing, as immense as houses, as tiny as dust particles, as rough as cobblestones, and as delicate and intricate as watch gears. The air turned hard. It appeared to have surfaces, corners, edges, as if space had been filled with huge coarse spheres, polished pyramids, and gigantic prickly crystals, and he was forced to make his way through all this, as if in a dream, pushing through a dark antique shop full of ancient, misshapen furniture. This only lasted for a moment. He opened his eyes, and everything disappeared. This wasn't another world. It was his same old world turning an unfamiliar side toward him, revealing it for an instant, then immediately sealing it off before he even had the chance to investigate. An irritated horn blared in his ear. Redrick sped up, then broke into a run, only stopping next to the hotel wall. His heart was racing, so he put down his briefcase and patiently tore open a pack of cigarettes and lit up. He was inhaling deeply, resting as if after a fight, and the policeman on beat walked up and asked anxiously, "Mister, would you like some help?"
No, Redrick forced out the word, then coughed. "It's a bit stuffy."
"Would you like me to walk with you?" Redrick bent down and picked up his briefcase. "I'm fine now," he said. "Nothing to worry about, buddy. Thank you."
He quickly walked toward the door, went up the stairs, and came into the lobby. It was cool, dim, and full of echoes. He would have liked to sit in one of the gigantic leather armchairs, come to his senses, and catch his breath, but he was already late. He only let himself finish his cigarette, watching the people around him through half-closed eyes. Boney was already here, looking irritated and rifling through the magazines at the newsstand. Redrick threw the cigarette butt into a trash can and got into the elevator. He didn't close the door in time, and a few people squeezed in next to him. A fat man breathing asthmatically, an over-perfumed woman with a sullen boy munching a chocolate bar, and a heavy old lady with a badly shaved chin. Redrick was squished into a corner. He closed his eyes so he wouldn't have to see the boy, whose mouth was dripping with chocolate saliva, but whose face was fresh, pure, without a single hair, so he wouldn't have to see his mother, whose meager bust was adorned with a necklace of black sparks set in silver, and so he wouldn't have to see the bulging, sclerotic eyes of the fat man and the repulsive warts on the old woman's bloated mug. The fat man tried to light a cigarette, but the old lady tore into him and continued berating him until the fifth floor where she got off. And as soon as she got off, the fat man finally lit up, looking like a man who had defended his rights, and then immediately began to cough, wheezing and gasping, extending his lips like a camel and jabbing Redrick in the ribs with his elbow. On the eighth floor, Redrick got off, and in order to let off some steam, loudly and emphatically declared, "Screw you, you old unshaven hag, and same to you, coughing cretin, and you, reeking broad with your snotty chocolate-covered punk, go to hell!"
Then he walked on the plush carpet along the hallway, which was bathed in the cozy light of hidden lamps. Here it smelled like fancy tobacco, Parisian perfumes, gleaming leather wallets overstuffed with banknotes, expensive call girls worth $500 a night, and massive gold cigar cases. It stank of vulgarity, of the foul scum that had grown on the zone, gotten rich by the zone, fed, drank, and fattened from the zone, and didn't give a damn. And especially didn't give a damn about what would happen when it gorged itself to its heart content, and all that used to be in the zone settled in the outside world. Redrick quietly pushed open the door of Suite 874. Raspy was sitting on a chair by the window and making a cigar. He was still wearing pajamas, and his thinning hair was damp, but it was already carefully combed over, and his sallow, puffy face was clean-shaven.
"Ah," he said, "punctuality is the courtesy of kings. Hello, my boy."
He finished snipping the end of the cigar, picked it up with both hands, brought it to his nose, and sniffed it from end to end. "And where's our old friend Burbage?" he asked, and lifted his eyes. His eyes were clear, blue, and angelic. Redrick put his briefcase on the couch, sat down, and took out his cigarettes.
"Burbage isn't coming," he said.
"But old Burbage," said Raspy, holding the cigar with two fingers and carefully bringing it to his mouth.
"Good old Burbage had a case of nerves."
He continued to stare at Redrick with his innocent blue eyes and didn't blink. He never blinked. The door opened slightly, and Boney squeezed into the room.
"Who was that man you were talking to?" he asked, straight from the doorway.
"Oh, hello," said Redrick amiably, flicking his cigarette ashes onto the floor. Boney stuffed his hands into his pockets and walked toward him, taking long strides with his giant pigeon-toed feet, and stopped in front of Redrick. "We've told you 100 times, he said reproachfully. "No get-togethers before the meeting. And what do you do?"
"Me?
I greet you," said Redrick. "And you?"
Raspy laughed, and Boney said irritably, "Hello, hello."
He stopped glaring at Redrick reproachfully and collapsed on the couch next to him.
"You can't do that," he said. "Got it? You can't."
"Then name a meeting place where I don't have any friends," said Redrick.
"The boy is right," noted Raspy. "Our mistake. So who was that man?"
"That was Richard Noonan," said Redrick. "He represents some firms that supply equipment to the Institute. He lives here in the hotel."
"You see how simple it is," said Raspy to Boney, picking up an enormous lighter shaped like the Statue of Liberty from the table. He looked at it doubtfully, then put it back.
"And where's Burbage?" said Boney, sounding completely mollified.
"Burbage is out," said Redrick.
The other two quickly exchanged glances.
"May he rest in peace," said Raspy wearily. "Or maybe he got arrested."
For some time, Redrick didn't reply, leisurely puffing on his cigarette. Then he threw the butt on the floor and said, "Don't worry, everything's fine. He's in the hospital."
"That's what you call fine," Boney said nervously, jumping up and walking to the window. "In which hospital?"
"Don't worry," repeated Redrick. "In the right hospital. Let's get down to business. I need sleep."
"In which hospital exactly?" asked Boney, already sounding irritated.
"I just told you," answered Redrick. He picked up his briefcase. "Are we going to do business or not?"
We are, my boy," Raspy said cheerfully. Showing unexpected agility, he jumped to his feet, briskly pushed a coffee table toward Redrick, and in a single motion swept the pile of newspapers and magazines onto the carpet. He sat down across from Redrick, putting his hairy pink hands on his knees. "Show us," he said. Redrick opened the briefcase, took out the list of prices, and laid it on the table in front of Raspy. Raspy looked at it and pushed it away with one finger. Boney, standing behind his back, stared at the list over his shoulder.
"That's the bill," said Redrick.
"I see that," replied Raspy. "Show us, show us."
"The money?" said Redrick.
"What is this ring?" Boney demanded, suspiciously jabbing his finger at the list over Raspy's shoulder.
Redrick was silent. He held the open briefcase on his knees and kept staring into the angelic blue eyes. Finally, Raspy chuckled.
"Why do I love you so much, my boy?" he cooed, "and they say there's no love at first sight." He sighed theatrically. "Phil, buddy, how do they say it around here? Pay the man. Give him some moolah. And pass me a match already, as you can see."
And he shook the cigar, still gripped between his fingers.
Boney grumbled something unintelligible, threw him a matchbox, and went into the neighboring room through a curtain-covered doorway.
Redrick heard him speaking irritably and indistinctly, saying something about a pig in a poke. Meanwhile, Raspy, having finally lit his cigar, kept examining Redrick with a fixed smile on his pale, thin lips and seemed to be considering something. So, Redrick put his chin on the briefcase and stared back, also trying not to blink, although his eyes were burning and he was tearing up. Then Boney returned, threw two bundles of cash down on the table, and, looking sullen, sat next to Redrick. Redrick lazily reached for the money, but Raspy gestured him to stop, unwrapped the cash, and stuffed the wrappers into his pocket. "Now you're welcome to it," he said. Redrick took the money and, without counting it, shoved it into an inner pocket of his jacket. After that, he spread out the swag. He did this slowly, giving them both a chance to examine each item and check it against the list. The room was silent, except for Raspy's laborious breathing and a barely audible clinking coming from behind the curtain, probably a spoon tapping a glass. When Redrick finally closed and locked his briefcase, Raspy looked up at him and asked, "All right. And our main object?" "Nothing," answered Redrick. He paused and added, "Yet." "I like that yet," said Raspy affectionately. "And you, Phil?" "You're muddling things, Shuhart," said Boney with distaste. "Why the secrecy, I ask?"
"This business is full of secrets," said Redrick. "It's a difficult business."
"Well, all right," said Raspy. "And where's the camera?" "Oh, shit." Redrick rubbed his cheek with his hand, feeling his face turn red.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I totally forgot."
"Over there?" asked Raspy, gesturing vaguely with his cigar.
"I'm not sure. Probably over there." Redrick closed his eyes and leaned back on the couch. "No, I really can't remember."
"Too bad," said Raspy. "But did you at least see it?"
"No, we didn't," said Redrick with vexation. "That's the thing. We didn't even make it to the furnaces. Burbage got into the slime and we turned right back. You can be sure that if I saw it, I wouldn't have forgotten."
"My God, Hugh, take a look," Boney suddenly said in a frightened whisper. "What the hell is this?" He was sitting with his right index finger extended tensely in front of him. Spinning around his finger was that same white metal bracelet, and Boney was staring at it, wild-eyed.
"It won't stop," Boney said loudly, moving his astonished eyes from the bracelet to Raspy and back again.
"What do you mean it won't stop?" Raspy said cautiously and drew back slightly.
"I put it on my finger and spun it once just for fun, and it's now been spinning a whole minute."
Boney bolted up and, holding his extended finger before him, ran through the curtain doorway. The bracelet, shimmering with silver, continued to rotate steadily in front of him like an airplane propeller.
"What's this you brought us?" asked Raspy.
"Hell if I know," said Redrick. "I had no idea. If I did, I would have charged more."
Raspy looked at him for some time, then got up and also disappeared through the doorway. Redrick immediately heard the murmur of voices. He took out a cigarette, lit up, picked up a magazine from the floor, and absent-mindedly flipped through it. The magazine was full of tight-bodied beauties, but for some reason, looking at them right now nauseated him. Redrick flung the magazine down and scanned the suite, searching for a drink. Then he pulled the money out of his pocket and counted the bills. Everything was fine, but in order to stay awake, he also counted the second pack. As he was putting it back in his pocket, Raspy returned.
"You're in luck, my boy," he announced, again sitting down across from Redrick. "Have you heard of perpetual motion?"
"Nope," said Redrick. "Didn't do that in school."
"Just as well," said Raspy. He pulled out another bundle of cash. "That's the payment for the first specimen," he declared, unwrapping the cash. "For every new specimen of this ring of yours, you'll get two such bundles. You got it, my boy? Two bundles, but only under the condition that no one but us ever finds out about these rings. Deal?"
Redrick silently put the money in his pocket and got up.
I'm going, he said. When and where next time? Raspy also got up. You'll get a call, he said. Wait by the phone every Friday from 9 to 9:30 in the morning. They'll send regards from Phil and Hugh and arrange a meeting. Redrick nodded and headed for the door. Raspy followed him, laying his hand on Redrick's shoulder. "There's something I want you to understand," he continued. "This is all very..."